It's time for a solid hour of Tea Party Power. And now, here's Janine Garofalo's favorite tea-bagging redneck, Mark Gillar.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. I am your host, Mark Gillar, and what a show we have lined up for you today. Three very excellent guests. We're going to be talking with Reverend C.L. Bryant. He is the president and founder of One Nation Back to God. He also is the author of the book, Lead Us to Temptation, Deliver Us to Evil, and he is the filmmaker behind the soon-to-be-released movie, Runaway Slave. Also on the show today, we have Patrice Lewis, who is the author of a book called The Simplicity Primer, a book that promises to help simplify all of our lives, get the clutter out of our lives, teach us how to live a simpler lifestyle, and save a little money while we're at it. And who doesn't need to do this as we face harder and harder economic times? But first up, Laurie Cardoza Moore. She is the president and founder of Proclaiming Justice to the Nations. She and her husband Stan are the filmmakers behind a movie called The Forgotten People, Christianity, and the Holocaust. Laurie, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mark. It's good to be back.
I'm glad to have you back. It's always encouraging when a guest is not so put off by me that they're willing to make a return visit. I'm just kidding. I watched, this is kind of like jury duty for conservatives, Lori. Everybody's number comes up every once in a while, and I guess yours has come up more than others.
But, well, I can't understand why.
I'm just kidding. Now, I watched the movie last night, and I got to tell you, it's one of those movies that just sort of really wakes you up. Now, you put a warning on the movie. There are some very disturbing images that don't seem to make it on television very often because, portraying Jews as victims just isn't that fashionable these days.
Well, yeah, and also showing who the victimizers are, radical Muslims, George Soros, and the far right wing. I mean, the Ku Klux Klan and the Quakers and those who ascribe to that mentality. Yeah, it's not. You're not going to see it on average television channels.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I haven't seen anything like this since I was a kid, and you know, the whole Holocaust television series was on. I haven't seen anything like this, and it's a reminder. It's a reminder that I think a lot of people need.
Mm-hmm. It certainly is. We actually came up with the concept to produce the film, and I want to encourage your listeners, even now, they can go visit our website at pjtn.org and learn more about this film that we're talking about, and they can also order it as well and share it with their family and friends. But the concept actually came about while I was attending the opening of the Skokie, Illinois Holocaust Museum a couple of years ago, and Elie Wiesel was speaking. As you know, Elie is a former, he's a Holocaust survivor, and he made a compelling statement that stuck with me while he was speaking, where he was talking about his experience in the Holocaust as a young boy, but he said, today we're facing a new type of anti-Semitism, and it's not just anti-Jewish this time. It's now we see that it's anti-Israel and it's anti-Zionist as well, and that stuck with me. And I came back to Nashville, and I told my husband, I said, I think there's something to this, and I said, I think we need to develop a documentary to talk about this. Let's go into the history and do the research. Because one of the other things, Mark, that I find really amazing is how little people really know about that time period. Yes, we've studied it in our history textbooks in school growing up, and we've seen some of the films on the History Channel and what have you. But I always ask the questions that nobody else seems to want to ask or address, and that is, you know, if Germany at that time was a Christian nation, because it was, and I've heard many Jewish people say that, you know, that Hitler was a Christian and the Christians did this, and I thought, no, the Christians couldn't have done this. But unfortunately, in the research that I did on this anti-Semitism or the history of anti-Semitism, which we go into quite extensively in the documentary, I was amazed at how Christians were, by and large, behind a lot of the persecution of the Jews since Jesus Christ. And so that was kind of a shocker to me. But through the film, we show how, you know, Christians were silent during the time of the pogroms. In fact, were involved in persecuting the Jews during the pogroms, during the Spanish Inquisition, in Nazi Germany. They were Christians. In fact, a lot of the Germans justified what they were doing to the Jews based on teachings from Martin Luther, who made some tremendous contributions to Christianity in his time. But unfortunately, toward the end of his life, he became a major anti-Semite and wrote a horrible book called The Jews and Their Lies. And unfortunately, that book has been, Hitler used that book to justify murdering the Jews. And, of course, the radical Islamic extremists use Hitler's teachings now to justify targeting the Jews. So it's an interesting bit of history that has been left out, and it's one that we focus on in bringing to a Christian audience, because I believe, Mark, that Christians should be the ones leading the charge to stop this anti-Semitism, the growth of it, because the Jewish people are our people. They are our family. They are our brethren in the faith. And unfortunately, because we have not been taught that historically through Christianity, we don't see the Jews as part of that family and worthy of our protection and our support. And so we set out through the...
I was going to say, in the movie you point out that Jews probably represent only, what, 0.1% of the people on the planet. How do you explain the intense hatred that so many different groups have toward the Jews, given the fact that it's such a small group of people? I mean, the intense hatred just seems, well, it's unfortunate, and the kind of thing that no one wants to see anyway. But whenever you see the small numbers that they represent, it's like, what did this group of people do to, in some people's mind, justify so much hatred against them?
Mm-hmm. Well, I see that as that affront to the Jews is because they are God's chosen people. And people have, throughout history, have had a difficult time dealing with that, especially Christians. And so Christians, if they didn't participate in persecuting the Jews, they stood by and basically turned a blind eye to it and allowed it to go on. But I think it really goes back all the way to the beginning of time when with Satan. And I believe that because Israel and the Jewish people are the apple of God's eye, because God made a covenant with Abraham and his descendants forever, Satan has continually chosen to target, to annihilate this people throughout the centuries. And I believe we see that. We're seeing it even evident today in modern-day society with what's unfolding in the Middle East, where now... You know, we have a leader, a charismatic leader, who is the president of the Judeo-Christian nation of the world, an educated nation. I mean, you see the similarities of what happened in Nazi Germany and what is happening today in our modern world. Hitler being very charismatic, coming to power when Germany was suffering economically. He implemented his own type of health care. He came to power, and of course he saw the Jews and targeted them even before he was elected. He was targeting the Jews as far back as 1922 in a speech where he had made that he wanted to hang the Jews from the gallows in the cities across Germany and burn them and hang them and let their stench fill the cities. I mean, that's just outrageous. And to think that Christians allowed somebody who would speak that way publicly to be elected, and of course now, you know, fast forward and remember, keeping in mind, again, Germany was a Christian nation. It was the most educated nation. It was the nation that gave us the birth of the Reformation. So here we are, fast forward, the United States of America.
Not to mention the Volkswagen.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
I'm just kidding.
Well, Well, I also use as experiments.
I was going to say, if I can just jump in for a second here.
Sure.
One of the things that you mentioned in the film is the one of the things that came up over and over again, and one of the reasons that a lot of Christians may have looked the other way is this mantra of the Jews killed Christ, the Jews killed Christ. Address that quickly and set the record straight on that.
Well, the whole murder of the Jew, of our Messiah, of Jesus Christ, was a Roman conspiracy. And unfortunately, because Christians don't understand history and what historically happened at that time, they blame all the Jews. But the Jews were not complicit with Christ's death. That was something that was done by the religious leaders. The religious leaders were involved with the Roman conspiracy, and people washed their hands and said, you know, they allowed it to happen. But because of that incident, historically, Christians have used that to justify their hatred toward the Jews. And I remember even being raised in the Catholic faith hearing that the Jews were the Jesus killers. And if we understand the scriptures correctly, if Christ died, he died willingly, number one, and number two, he died so that he died for the sin of all mankind. You can't target one people group and blame them. So yes, Christians have used that excuse and blamed him and justified what they were doing. That's why Hitler justified what he was doing, annihilating the Jews. He was finishing the work of Martin Luther. And what Martin Luther, in fact, if you saw in the film where Martin Luther had made some statements that the Jews should be burned in their synagogues, locked in there and burned in their synagogues. I mean, and look at what Hitler was doing. He set synagogues on fire. There were Jews that were killed in those synagogues. So you see this history being repeated, you know, again, and now you look at what's happening today, and now it's not focusing on targeting the Jews specifically. It's the new anti-Semitism. And we discuss in the film that, you know, the new anti-Semitism is not just anti-Jewish now, it's anti-Israel and anti-Zionist as well. And who's fueling this new anti-Semitism? Well, we know it's being fueled by the far right, people like the Ku Klux Klan, even the Quakers. I was just reading where the Quakers now are boycotting Israel and condemning Israel. You have people from the left, people like George Soros, who are funding these vicious attacks against the state of Israel, his own people. And then, of course, radical Islam. And we see that with the attempt to delegitimize Israel's right to exist in the land that God gave to them. And the scriptures are very clear who that land was given to. So you have radical Islam who is continuing to perpetrate this against the Jewish people. And then you have the President of the United States, President Obama, who is not targeting the Jews specifically, but he's putting pressure on the Jewish state and trying to delegitimize Israel's right to maintain the borders that she has. And so, of course, we saw back in May when Obama made that speech where he said that, you know, Israel needs to go back to 1967 borders. And, of course, there was a major outcry from the United States, from the citizens. And, of course, we saw Congress reflect our views, thank God, when Bibi Netanyahu spoke before Congress back in May. So, yes, this is unfortunately an ongoing problem, and history does repeat itself, and what we're trying to do through the film is educate Christians so that we don't allow history to be repeated in our day. I mean, we're only 66 years removed from the Holocaust. We should know better. We should know our history, and unfortunately, we don't.
Well, it's amazing how, especially now that I'm in my late 40s, how 66 years doesn't seem that long ago. You're looking at that and going, you know, we haven't had that much time to change. And this isn't an example of anti-Semitism, but I'm looking at the cover of your film, and it's got the hand with the tattoo on the wrist. And just a couple of weeks ago, a well-known global warmist said that he would like to see every single global warming skeptic on the planet tattooed. With the reason that they don't believe in global warming. And then I went on to Twitter and I found people repeating that. And so my response was, so you want to do to global warming skeptics what the Nazis did to the Jews. Please explain why you think that's still acceptable. And it's amazing to me that people still have some of the same types of thoughts that the Nazis had 60 years ago.
Well, you know what, Mark? Unfortunately, mankind doesn't change. And evil is still the same evil, no matter what generation it decides to rear its ugly head in. So there's nothing in the Bible that says very clearly in Ecclesiastes that there is nothing new under the sun. And unfortunately, if we do not study history, then we will be doomed to repeat it. And that's why we do study history, and that's why producing this film was very important to me, because I wanted to make sure that Christians understood that we were silent back then. And there's a great little prophetic book in the Bible called the Book of Obadiah. It's a very short read, but very powerful. And it's where God tells the prophet Obadiah that in the latter days he's going to wipe out the descendants of Edom because they stood by while their brother Jacob, or Israel, was held in captivity and they did nothing. And that's why I am asking the church, you know, if God is going to wipe out the Edomites because they stood by while their brother was held in captivity, how will God judge Christians? How will God judge the church? How will he judge the church during the pogroms or during the Spanish Inquisition or during the Holocaust or even today, now, if the church is silent? Because God is very serious about Israel and about the Jewish people, and we must protect the Jewish people. If you look at what's happening economically around the world, I mean, we see even our country is crashing economically. But you look at Israel and how Israel is prospering like no other country in the world. Why is that? As you said earlier, it's a small country made up of a small number of people. So how could they be prospering this way? And it's because God's word is true. He's not a man that he should lie. He doesn't have to. He makes no excuses for his choices, but he has strategically placed these people on the earth throughout the generations to be a light unto the nations. And we as Christians should recognize that the Jewish people are our brethren, and they deserve our support. They deserve for us to speak out on their behalf, and that's what we're attempting to do through this film. And so, again, I want to encourage your listening audience to visit our website at pjtn.org and order a copy of the documentary. You know, the film has been broadcasting, Mark, around the globe over the last year. We have been getting emails and phone calls, emails from around the globe, like South Africa, the UK. We're getting hits to our website from all over the world and going to watch this film or going to order this film so that they can share with their family and friends. And the emails that I get, everyone that responds says, I need to share this film with my family. I need to share it with my friends in my community, because our whole goal was to make sure that we are protecting our Jewish brethren in the communities that we live in around the globe, and also defending and protecting the state of Israel. God said to Abraham in Genesis 12:3, I will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you, and all the nations of the world will be blessed through you. If the Palestinians want to be blessed, if they want peace, they need to start blessing their neighbor, the Jewish people.
Right now in America, I think it would be fair to say there is what David Horowitz called an unholy alliance between the American left and radical Muslim extremists. Given that, why do we see such a high level of support in the Jewish community for left-wing socialist types like Barack Obama?
Well, I think a lot of it comes from the fact that the Jewish people primarily are very concerned about social issues. And, of course, it comes out of a result of what's happened historically. And, unfortunately, we can blame Christians for allowing this to happen. That's why there is this wall of division between Jews and Christians. It's because Christians stood by and would not protect the Jewish people. And so as a result of that, they are constantly watching out to protect the weak, or what they consider the weaker of society, against the more tyrant, and that's how they see it. Unfortunately, you know, I can also look at the Christian community, Mark, because the Jewish vote, even, you know, if you add up all the Jewish people in the United States and they all vote together for one candidate who supports values we don't support, it's the Christians that have the vote to undo that.
Unfortunately,
Christians, by and large, have supported Obama. I had one individual who is a Christian woman who's no longer going to be supporting PJTN because of our position. And that is very frightening, because Christians are being sucked into this as well. And thinking, I mean, I hear all the time where they're supporting Obama and they don't see what he's doing. And I have to say, look at his position with Israel. If you don't take anything else, look at what he's doing to Israel.
I haven't looked at the numbers. Lori, I haven't looked at the numbers specifically for Christians, but I have looked at the Jewish numbers and the Catholic numbers. And you would think, for Catholics who do not agree in any way with abortion, that it would be a no-brainer. But yet the over 50% of Catholics voted for Barack Obama, even though he's got one of the most pro-abortion voting records in the history of the U.S. Senate, even though he wasn't there that long a time. So my thought is what are Catholics thinking when they support this guy? What are Jews thinking when they support this guy? I mean, he's like some kind of a magic Pied Piper, and everyone just needs to wake up.
Well, I think with the Jewish community, since his speech back in May, I think it was a major wake-up call. To anybody who was not sure where he stood, it's very clear now where he stands. In fact, one of his biggest contributors, Haim Saban, pulled back funding from him as a result of that speech and told Obama he needed to go to Israel. Well, Obama has yet to visit Israel. And, you know, I think what a lot of people don't realize, and a lot of Christians did believe that Obama was a Christian and that his intentions and his motives are honorable. But if he is a Christian, then why is he implementing policies that fly in the face of the Word of God? And if he's a Christian, then why did he cover up some of the Christian symbols at Notre Dame when he went and spoke there before he was elected? If he's a Christian, why hasn't he visited the Holy Land of Israel yet? There's been countless Muslims who have publicly come out saying he is not Christian. He is a Muslim. His dad was a Muslim. His grandfather was a Muslim. And even Obama said in the interview with Stephanopoulos that he was a Muslim, his Muslim faith. And Steffi had to correct him.
Yeah, I have that video on my hard drive, Lori. And, of course, he's going to say it was just a misspeak. What he meant to say was my, you know, alleged Muslim faith. But, no, it's obvious, and we can add to that list, that whenever he was in Jakarta, I believe, his parents enrolled him in an expensive Catholic school. And I can't recall whether it's his mother or his stepfather's handwriting, but he was listed on that application form as a Muslim. And in fact, on his website for the longest time, he had a statement that he's never been a Muslim. And when that document surfaced, he changed it to, I've never been a practicing Muslim. So there's no doubt. I mean, even his sister Myra, I think in an attempt to defend him, but actually ended up, proving to the world that they were Muslims, you know, said, hey, growing up, you know, we were Muslim. Everybody we knew was Muslim. So, yeah, there's no question that he was. And, you know, it's like I was arguing with Caroline Heldman at Occidental. She came on the show a couple of months ago. And she goes, well, Mark, I mean, haven't your parents ever filled out a form for you when you were little and maybe they put something on there that you didn't necessarily agree with? And my thought was, you know, if I had been raised in a Muslim family and had, you know, essentially given up that faith and moved on to Catholicism or becoming a Protestant, or it doesn't matter. I moved on to some other faith, and I were running for office, and someone said, "Hey, Mark, were you ever a Muslim? Are you a Muslim?" I probably would say, "Well, you know, I was raised in a Muslim family, and when I got old enough to make my own decision, I converted to whatever." You know, I wouldn't say, "Oh, no, no, no." You know, and so there's just something inherently dishonest about this guy. Why? I don't know why he can't just say, "I was raised in a Muslim family, I was a Muslim, and then when I got old enough to make my own decision, I decided to become a Black liberation theologist."
That's exactly right, and there's the point right there. You know, he, if he left his Islamic faith and decided to come under Reverend Jeremiah Wright, what was he coming out under? It wasn't Christianity. It was Black liberation theology, which is not biblical. In fact, it is heresy. And the fact that Jeremiah Wright even puts a white collar on his neck and tries to come off as being a Christian pastor is outrageous. And for Obama to justify his Christianity because of 23 years of sitting under Reverend Wright, then I'm sorry, that does not make you a Christian. He's, Reverend Jeremiah Wright is not preaching the gospel. He is not preaching the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He is preaching Black liberation theology, which is totally flies in the face of our Judeo-Christian principles and our values. And so, you know, for Obama to try to make us believe that he's something that he's not, I mean, the fact that he's not even gone to Israel. I mean, what sitting president has never made a trip this long in his position, has never made a trip to the Holy Land? I mean, that just, that boggles the mind. You know, if you look historically at what Obama has done, even look at his association right now, Mark. I mean, he's currently pushing for the Muslim Brotherhood to have a seat at the table in Egypt. He's now saying, and the Secretary of State is saying, that we need to start communicating with the Muslim Brotherhood. They're a terrorist organization. We, as the United States of America, the leader of the free world, do not sit down with Muslim terrorist groups, and we don't give money to them. But what is Obama doing? We find out that the Palestinian Authority, Fatah, has now formed a unity government with Hamas, a terrorist group. And what are we doing? We're still writing them checks. Our tax dollars. That is against our federal laws. And where is the outcry from the American people holding our congressmen accountable, saying, "Wait a minute, you guys hold the purse strings. What are we doing?" And as far as the whole UN, the UN pushing for a Palestinian state, well, Obama, of course, inserts himself into the debate and says, "Bibi, if you don't, you know, work with me and agree to my views of what land you should have in the Middle East, then guess what? You're going to have to contend with the UN." I don't think so. Who does Obama think he's representing? He is not representing we, the people of the United States of America. And it's high time that we as Americans unite together and put Israel at the top of the reason why we should vote. You know, 2012, Mark, is coming, and it's going to be fast upon us. And it's going to be very important if this nation, if the United States of America, wants to enjoy the blessings of Almighty God again, we are going to have to get our priorities right. And at the top of that priority list must be Israel. Because if we will stand with Israel and we will bless Israel by putting leaders in places of authority over us that will protect our relationship with the Jewish people and with the Jewish state, then this nation will again be blessed. But if we continue to be self-focused and concerned about our economy and how is this, you know, something, if we want our economy to prosper, then we better bless what God blesses. And as we obey his word, then he will honor us, and we will be blessed in the interim.
Lori, I am sorry, but we are out of time. Can you please tell the folks at home one more time how they can get a copy of this film?
They can visit our website again, Mark, at pjtn.org. I want to appreciate all of you for joining us. Please sign up, get our blog. We have a daily blog that goes out. Register to get that on the website. sign up to get our newsletters and e-blasts, and stay informed, stay educated about this issue, and then make the calls to your congressman, and then, of course, find the candidates who are going to support Israel and support them.
Lori, once again, thanks for being on. Always a pleasure.
God bless you, Mark. Always a pleasure being with you as well.
My next guest is Patrice Lewis, who is the author of The Simplicity Primer, 365 Ideas for Making Life More Livable. Patrice, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
This book has a lot of great information in it. I'm going to be honest, I'm not through reading it, but as I flip through, I believe that it lives up to its name. It has some very simple advice for simplifying one's life. What is it that led you to write this book?
Well, I've always been interested in the concept of simplicity. That probably dates back to my college years. And my frustration was that every book that I had read on the subject, and there are many books that are on the subject, tend to deal with it from a left-wing or alternative proposal, and I really didn't have time to go on meditation retreats and do yoga and all this kind of nonsense, and I really wasn't interested in hugging trees. And in addition, I don't believe any of that is really a simplicity concept. It's fine if you want to eat organic granola. It's fine if you want to hug trees. But it doesn't do anything to simplify your life.
It sounds more complicated.
In a way, yes. And I remember the very moment when I decided to write this book. It was early in the morning, and I was on Amazon.com, and I was trolling, once again, the books on that subject, trying to find something in vain that would reflect my particular views on it, finding nothing. And it just came over me like a thunderclap. I'm just as qualified to write on this issue as anybody else. And the funny thing is that by everybody's definition, my husband and I are living what people call the simple life. Because we have a 20-acre farm in North Idaho, and we raise our own cattle, and we milk our own cows, and we grow our own food, and this, that, and the other. And I can assure you very quickly that is not a simple life. So what I realized was that simplicity can be boiled down to three words, and those words are make good choices. So if you go through your life making good, sound, rational, logical, well-thought-out decisions and choices throughout, you're probably going to end up with a much simpler life than those who do stupid things their whole life long. And so that was kind of the genesis of the book, and I ended up just, oh, heavens, ideas were pouring out of me. I wrote the initial draft of 101 tips very, very quickly. And that was kind of just how the whole thing started.
Well, now, one of the things I saw, and I believe I've got this one marked, it's on page 327, is you talk about how to actually simplify the clutter in a home, and I don't think I've ever seen sounder or straightforward advice. I mean, it was essentially gather up everything you own, pick the things that you don't need and get rid of them, and then organize the things you've got left. I mean, is that essentially it?
That's essentially it. Now, that particular idea I had borrowed from somebody's blog. I saw his advice on that. I thought it was brilliant, and so I emailed him for permission to use his ideas. Because it's hard to get, well, pardon the term, hard to get much simpler than that. Essentially, we have Americans, if we have one fault, it's that we tend to collect a lot of things. We just accumulate a lot of junk and clutter, not without, you know, it tends to be sort of an unconscious process, but nonetheless we do. And once in a while, we just need to purge it all, because really too many possessions obviously are going to bog you down in ways that you just can't imagine. So this particular fellow's suggestion was, throw it all in the middle of the room. Just throw it all in the middle of the room into one humongous pile and then start sorting through it. Keep only what you need, put that away, and get rid of the rest. And it's especially with kids, you know how those things sort of tend to accumulate. And so we have done that every so often, just done a gigantic, massive purge, and it really helps.
It sounds like one of those things that you look at and you go, boy, that's pretty simple advice. Why don't I just do that? But it's probably also one of those things that's a lot harder to actually do than it is to write down. So how do you actually make that happen? I mean, the advice is very simple, but I have a feeling that maybe carrying it out, implementing it might not be. What do you do to get off the chair and make this happen?
Oddly enough, it's kind of a strange source for me. I have a peculiar fascination for people who live with squalor. I don't know if you're familiar with the clinical term, but it's people who have a mental condition, a very serious mental condition, in which they live under horrible squalor conditions, filth and piles of garbage and all this kind of thing.
There's a show on television called Hoarders. sounds like what we're talking about.
It may be. We don't get television reception, and so I'm not familiar with what's on, but that wouldn't surprise me.
We're talking about people that have every square inch of their home covered in filth so badly that you would need a shovel to start getting it out.
Yes. And okay. There is nothing more inspiring to get your own house clean than seeing just one or two photos.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I think every time that show's on the air, we start running around the house picking things up.
It's amazing how it works. It's very effective, yes.
So I'm guessing most of the people that are listening right now aren't in that category, but let's say things are a little messier than they should be, a little more cluttered than they should be. I think the tough part is deciding, once you put everything in the middle of the living room, which item goes in which pile. What types of things do we really need, and what types of things do we have just because we want them?
Well, there's obviously a lot of crossover. One of the difficulties people have is nothing becomes more precious than when you're about to throw it out. And children are famous for that.
Oh, yeah.
Children are famous for that. They simply cannot give up a toy even though they haven't, you know, looked at it in a year.
My son is 20 years old. We have stuff in his room that goes back 20 years. He doesn't want to get rid of it.
It's difficult. You have an emotional attachment to things. I still have a few trinkets from my own childhood, and everyone does. Everybody does. So one of the suggestions is take all of the things you really have no particular use for but are not emotionally ready to give up yet, stick it in a box somewhere in the basement or the garage or somewhere out of sight, and just don't open it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can go for a year without caring what's in that box, just don't open it and give it to Goodwill. But
have said if you take a picture of the item, that some people are more willing to let go of it knowing that they can at least go back and look at the picture.
That is actually very true. About 10 or 15 years ago, my mother gave me a box of items she had found from my early childhood, and I'm pulling out these things going, oh, I remember this. Well, I had no use for them, and this is when we still lived in Oregon, and our house was tiny. We had no room for any clutter. And so I did just that. I took pictures of the items and gave it away. And I felt it's a much easier thing if I have some sort of memory of it.
Yeah, I think it's the memory that's important, not necessarily the item in and of itself.
It's just the memory.
Well, you know, one of the things, too, I think some people might hear the title of your book and they may have listened to what we've talked about so far, especially, you know, how you're living your life right now, and they might think, oh, wow, if I get that book, she's going to try to turn me into somebody who lives on a farm without electricity and churns his or her own butter. That's not really the goal of this book, is it?
No, and in fact, that's one of the things I was trying to do throughout the book was to deconstruct a lot of the myths surrounding simplicity, because I can assure you, living in the country is not a simple issue. We do, and it's not simple. It's fun. It's nice. We love it, but it's not simple. And it also implies that if you don't live on a farm, then you cannot live a simple life, and of course, nothing could be farther from the truth. So the whole concept is that simplicity is something that is achievable by virtually everyone under virtually any circumstances, virtually no matter where you live. It's just a matter of making good choices. I don't care if you're in a New York City high-rise apartment. I don't care if you're on a 20-acre farm. It's all a product of making good choices. And everyone's choices, of course, are different. But some of the big ones would be choose the right spouse to marry. I mean, how much bigger can you get? Choose to treat that spouse with a great deal of love and kindness. And that way your marriage will stay intact. How much better can life be than to have a strong, solid foundation of marriage? That same applies to children. If you raise your children with a great deal of training and discipline and love and affection and give them the blessing of a secure marriage, you're going to raise good kids. And that simplifies their life, and believe me, that simplifies your life too. We've got two teen girls, and by all accounts, this is the age where they reach the ultimate of snarkiness, and we haven't had any of that at all. So it's really big picture items that I try to focus on. I mean, there's a few things like, you know, keeping your house without getting clutter and things like that. But the big picture items are what's really going to simplify your life.
Do you actually advocate a divorce if someone, I know it's something that you wouldn't suggest people do lightly, but do you advocate that if someone realizes that a big part of the non-simplicity is they chose the wrong spouse?
Of course. Now, obviously, I'm a great believer in the sanctity of marriage, and this is something that I do not recommend people undergo for trivial reasons. But there are clearly issues if you've got issues of abuse or addictions or or anything of that nature, something that threatens your life or your livelihood, obviously that can't go on. And the security of your children are paramount. And so there are obviously situations where a marriage should end, in which case I recommend please choose more wisely in the future. I have seen people go through serial marriages, I mean, choosing again and again and again the wrong person, and it's just that is not leading to a simple life. And it's important to remember it is a choice. Presumably nobody is holding a gun to your head and forcing you to marry somebody. So I understand making a mistake. I mean, obviously things do happen. But one thing to remember also is any mistakes you have made in the past cannot be undone. You can't change the past. But anything that's within your grasp in the future can indeed lead to a simpler life. Case in point, I have a friend who has a very, very rocky marriage. And she regrets very much marrying the man she did. But she had, oddly enough, a religious conversion a few years ago. And it is astounding how much it has changed her life for the better. She realizes that she cannot change her husband. She has to only change herself. So her relationship with her husband is actually more peaceful. The children now have a stronger foundation because the marriage is calmer and they have a religious background to fall on now, and it's really astounding how different they are than they were 4 or 5 years ago. So whatever mistakes you have made in the past cannot be undone. It cannot be changed. But you have the choice, and remember that word, choice, to make better decisions in the future. And that's kind of the premise of the whole book, really. Just think things through. People don't seem to think things through.
Well, you know, when I hear you talking about making people's lives simpler, one of the things that I think of is that from an early, early age in American society, we have materialism inculcated from a variety of sources, you know, into our psychological makeup. So when you grow up in a country and you spend your formative years in a country where everybody's got to have an iPad and everybody's got to have an iPhone and everybody's got to have, you know, the latest gadgets in their car and the best stereo, and it just goes on and on and on. How do we deprogram what in many cases is decades of programming?
Well, a lot of it, when you think about it, has to do with one's personal ego. An example I give in the book is we had a faithful little runabout car, and after many, many, many years of good service, it died. And somebody had meanwhile given us a really ugly, but ugly boat of a car. I called it the pimp mobile. It was just hideous. And I was truly embarrassed to be seen driving that, but it was the only vehicle we had. And the one thing that I found to my astonishment, I mean, I was quite literally astonished by this, is that nobody gave a rip what I was driving. Nobody cared. And my embarrassment about driving this old beat-up vehicle that looked like it should be used for alternative purposes was simply a product of my ego. And I don't really have an ego wrapped up in a vehicle. I've never been that way. And yet, I was embarrassed to be seen driving with this. So, but my friends didn't care. Nobody cared. Nobody even looked twice at me. It was all in my mind. So if we realize that much of our desire to acquire things is just a product of ego, a wish to keep up with the Joneses, a wish to be thought successful, whatever reason you purchase things, fashion and electronics and makeup, and that goes on and on and on, it's all ego. And it's hard to do, to put that ego aside. But when you do, you start realizing who your real friends are and who is just attracted to you for the things you do or own.
That's a good point. And one of the things I've noticed in my life is that early on, my wife and I really struggled financially. I mean, it was a struggle. And it's like that for a lot of people. I don't think most young newlyweds see that coming. But, I mean, we went through some very, very lean times. And what I recall during that time is that, you know, I was so embarrassed to, like, pick up some food somewhere and use a coupon. Or I was so embarrassed if someone invited us to join them at a restaurant, even though we didn't have the money to be there in the first place, I would always order something a little on the expensive side because I was concerned that someone might think, oh, wow, you know, Mark had to go with the daily special because he can't afford the more expensive items. And now, not that I'm wealthy, but now that I'm doing financially much better than I was then, I'll go into a restaurant and I'll ask what the daily special is. I'll whip out that coupon. I don't care what anybody else thinks because it's just not important to me anymore. But at one time, it really was, and it's hard to get past that. And I always thought Sam Walton of Walmart fame was a great example. That guy drove a beat-up old pickup truck.
Until and it got him from point A to point B.
It did, and that's what a car is supposed to do. But
Right. Again,
in I think America, more than any place else, we have this ego issue. And someone pointed out once, take an American commercial and put any other country, inject any other country into that and see if it doesn't look silly to you.
Yeah.
I mean, we used to have these beer commercials, you know, go for it, America, you've got the gusto now. Try sticking Thailand or Korea in there and see if that doesn't seem like a silly commercial.
It does put things in perspective, absolutely.
Yeah, so I don't know. I just think that, first of all, I like what I've read of the book. It's great advice, but I think of all the countries in the world where you could have introduced this, this is going to be the one where, first of all, it's most needed, and secondly, where people are going to be so programmed that they may or may not take your advice. What's your response to that? Can Americans overcome how we've been programmed since day one?
We may be facing a future where we don't have much of a choice.
Excellent.
And that's actually, the timing of this book is better than I had hoped for. Of course, I had no control over the timing, but the release during a time of economic uncertainty and a future that's uncertain at best means that a lot of people who had been making a decent income and who had been able to afford the best are suddenly plunged into a situation where they're eating beans and rice.
That's right.
And so it's a question of, once again, it's not... What I'm hoping people will realize is that there is nothing shameful about eating beans and rice. They're very healthy for you. So the idea that we are what we do or we are what we own has got to come to a screeching halt during a time of economic uncertainty, because we cannot keep spending ourselves into debt at a time when we may not be able to pay that debt back. I discuss debt a lot because we've been in debt. We've gotten out of debt. It's no fun to be there. And if you're going to spend purely as a product of ego in order to keep up with the Joneses or to impress your coworkers or anything like that, that's got to stop. And I'm hoping I can make people understand that there's nothing shameful in having it stop. There's nothing shameful at it all. Nobody thinks the lesser of you. They really don't, for brown bagging your lunches at work.
I think, first of all, you stole one of my questions for you. I was going to ask you, could the timing have been any better for this book in terms of what's happening with the economy? And you've answered that. And, you know, that is absolutely the truth. I remember hearing somewhere, I think it was a guy who had written a little, not really a song, but a little speech for high school graduations. I think the name of it was, what is it? Trust Me About the Sunscreen or I can't remember what the title was, and one of the things he said in there is that whenever you become older, the friends you had when you were younger can be the most important people in your life. And, you know, that's one of the things I've noticed is that my true friends, I mean the real friends, are the ones that were there with us when we were living in the rundown apartment and driving the old car that we always had to have a pair of jumper cables.
And
those people are still in our lives, and they don't care whether we're living in a shack or living in a decent house or whatever. The people who really matter, the people who are really going to be there for you, are going to love you no matter what. And I think this extremely superficial society that we live in right now, which is, you know, promoted by television, is something that if this economic hard times that we're going through, which could certainly become which they certainly could become harder in the near future, does anything, maybe it can wake America up out of that, you know, from being in that mentality, that mindset.
I had an interesting incident. My oldest daughter is 15, and last year when she was 14, she made an interesting observation. We were familiar with a church here in town who is the Second Harvest Distributors, and the folks who were distributing the food made a comment one time that the people who receive the food are often not grateful for what they get, and they might complain about the quality of it or why don't you have this and such and this kind of thing. And I was relating this story to my daughter, and she was very indignant, and she said maybe a depression would do them some good. And by depression, she meant an economic depression.
Mm-hmm.
And she was very annoyed at the people in the story. And now, of course, an economic depression is not something I'd wish on my worst enemy. But
right.
her greater sentiment was actually somewhat wise, which was, people need sometimes to have a good clunk upside the head. The abundance in this country, even among the most frugal, and I like to think we're a fairly frugal family, but even we take the abundance for granted. And it's, you have to sometimes stop and think, would this abundance be available in Bangladesh or in Nigeria? Of course not. And God forbid we should ever get to that point, but if there is an economic depression, food is not something we're going to be taking for granted, or any luxury. Water, clean water, or, you know, a warm bed or anything like that is not a luxury we'll be taking for granted. And so the idea that Second Harvest recipients could be indignant about the quality or the quantity of food they receive really tweaked her buttons. This is my daughter's buttons. And she recognized that, to use the cliche, gratitude really is an attitude.
Well, I think there's a good example of that. There was a doctor who volunteered during Hurricane Katrina and found that the people that were standing in line for the food were complaining about the quality of it. I'm in Texas. I'm about 100 miles northwest of Houston, and we know that a lot of the people from Katrina actually ended up in the Astrodome in Houston, you know, again, a very short distance from where I'm talking to you from right now. And again, we saw some of the same things there, that people were not appreciative of what was being done. So, you know, I think your daughter makes a strong point. Now, my parents were raised in the immediate aftermath of the Great Depression. My parents were both born in 1936. They know what it's like to do without. And I can recall being a kid and being at my grandparents' house, and one of my great aunts was there, and they were serving cornbread. And I simply said, I'm not going to eat any cornbread. I don't like that. And my great aunt looked at me and she said, there might come a day when you wish you had some cornbread, young man. And she said that whenever she had talked to some other ladies who were not born in the United States but had come to the United States from Czechoslovakia, and whenever they hit Ellis Island, one of the first things they had was this family helped them out and gave them some food, and one of the things they gave them was some cornbread. And she said they said that they were so hungry because the food was so scarce on the ship that
right.
that cornbread tasted like cake. And she said, there might come a day, young man, whenever that cornbread tastes like cake to you. And, you know, I'm in my late 40s, and frankly, based on what's happening right now, she might still be proven to be right before I'm done. So.
Well, that is a fact. And my mother was born in 31, and so she lived through, she was a child who must have the Depression, and she lived in utter, absolute, unspeakable poverty. Down in the Louisiana Bayou, she didn't speak English till she went to school, and her father was a fisherman. And they had so little money and so little food that even as a young woman, she was married at the age of 27 and she still weighed 87 pounds.
Oh,
so
my goodness.
Literal starvation as a child. And so I think I've grown up with the notion that to be grateful for what we have. I don't think she's ever faced the possibility that kind of poverty could happen again. In fact, I think she's kind of in denial it could ever happen again because the memories were so bad.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, the attitude I grew up with is appreciate what you have. Because we do have a tremendous number of blessings in this country, in spite of all the problems that we face. We still have a tremendous number of blessings.
My mother tells me that whenever she was a little girl, initially her family was so poor that they needed a place to live and literally moved into a house that had partially burned down. And they just sectioned off the parts that, you know, were unlivable and lived in the parts of the house that were. And, you know, so few of us can relate to anything like that now. Now, her parents saved their money and put down a down payment on a grocery store and actually ended up doing well, you know, throughout much of the latter part of their lives. But
they did
initially,
well because of thrift and very, very hard work.
Absolutely. I mean, I cannot even begin to tell you how hard both sets of grandparents, you know, that I have worked, one on a farm and one with their own store that, you know, they just worked tirelessly at. And I don't know that any of us know much about that type of sacrifice. I remember seeing this comedian once who was raised in Beverly Hills, and he said when he was a kid, roughing it was when the heater went out on the swimming pool.
Right.
And I think that while that might be an extreme example, most of us now most of us now can't even begin to relate to that. So let's get back into the book for a second. I mean, you give a lot of advice in this book. How do you, one of the things you talk about is picking your housekeeping battles. Now, what exactly does that mean?
Well, a lot of people get very frantic, women especially, men aren't quite so afflicted with this, but a lot of women get frantic on the notion that, oh my gosh, my house has to be clean, has to be perfect, has to be this, has to be that. Especially when guests come over. And I don't think there's any woman on the planet who's quite immune to that. I certainly have been known to goad my kids into cleaning up before we have house guests.
Sure.
Nonetheless, the idea that the house has to be perfect at all times is a detriment in two ways. One is that it's a hassle. I mean, if you're constantly cleaning, then you are enslaved to your house rather than the reverse. But two, it tends to be you don't want to live in a museum. A house is for living. You know, if there's a few dirty socks on the floor, big whoop.
I noticed in the book you talked about the difference between a house and a home.
Oh, a huge difference. I remember when my husband and I were first married, this was 21 years ago, and we decided to get a puppy. And so we went to this, we answered an ad and went to this house where these dogs had been bred. And I don't think I've ever seen such a beautiful, exquisite, flawless home. The dogs, naturally, were outside, and so we signed the paperwork and we're paying her the money and this, that, and the other inside the house, and I'm looking at around it going, there's no possible way I could ever throw my feet up on the coffee table and relax. It was too much of a museum piece. And I thought, now that's the difference between a house and a home. This is a house. It certainly isn't a home. And meanwhile, we've got some friends who live down the road who live in a barn, a metal barn, a small metal barn. They originally planned to build a house, and they just didn't have the money. They wanted to go without a mortgage. So they ended up retrofitting the barn for habitation, and it's small, and it's got concrete floors, and it has very few windows, and people will literally line up to visit these people because the husband and the wife, they offer such gracious hospitality, and there's always a cup of tea available, and there's always something warm from the oven, and they just have this magical ability to make you feel at home despite the surroundings. And that's the kind of place that it doesn't matter. They could live in a tent in the desert, and it would still be a home. Quite a nice family to aspire toward, to be honest, because they truly distinguish between what a house and a home is.
I have relatives that have houses. and they're I'm good friends with them, and I mean, I'm not saying anything negative about them, but I think when I visited there at Christmas, I stopped counting at the seventh fireplace.
Oh my!
Yeah, so I know what you're talking about in terms of those movies, and those places are fun to visit. They really are, but I don't know that they're necessarily fun to live in.
Exactly.
Now, one of the things you also say here, and we've got about a minute and a half left, is you talk about the need to accept mortality. Tell our listeners what that means.
Well, you can't fight the inevitable. I mean, as the saying says, nothing is sure but death and taxes. And this was hit home rather hard a few years ago when my college roommate, one of my best friends, her husband got a malignant brain tumor, and he lingered for a year, and then he died. And it left her widowed with two very young children, 3 and 9. And it was a slap in the face because up to this point he'd been healthy, he exercised, he ate right, did everything possible. You just never know when the end will come. And one of the things that I suggest people do is, first of all, make sure your future is assured, if you know what I mean. I tend to be of a religious persuasion, and I urge people to follow suit as well. But in addition, live your life without regret. I had a breast cancer scare a number of years ago, and it made me realize if I were to die tomorrow, would I die with regret as to how I've treated my husband, how I've raised my girls, how I've lived my life? And it's a powerful moment of adjustment. If you're faced with the end and you can't, you want to make changes now while you still have the time. Don't wait until you are literally on your deathbed and have regret.
Well, we are almost out of time. Tell the folks at home real quickly how they can get a copy of this book.
It's available online. Either from the publisher or from Amazon. If you would go to the website www.simplicityprimer.com, there is a page on that website that indicates where people can get copies.
I feel like we just barely scratched the surface on this book. Not to put you under any pressure on the air, but is there a chance you'll come back and talk to us a little bit more about this book?
I would love to. I so enjoy radio interviews. They're wonderful.
Patrice, I want to thank you for being on the show. It's a wonderful book, and I look forward to having you back in the near future.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
My next guest is Reverend C.L. Bryant. He is the founder of the movement One Nation Back to God. He is the author of the recently released Lead Us to Temptation, Deliver Us to Evil. And he is also the filmmaker behind the new movie, Runaway Slave. C.L. Bryant, welcome to the show. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks, Mark. I'm certainly happy to be here, and I want to say hello to all of those patriots out there in America who help keep this nation strong and great.
Thank you very much. I know they appreciate it, and it's just amazing what's happened with this Tea Party movement. You know, there are so many people, usually progressives, who have been quick to predict our early demise, and it just hasn't happened.
Well, the news of our demise has been greatly exaggerated, to use the words of Mark Twain. It is, however, it is, however, important that we do remain visible. I do see some deterioration in the organization groups, smaller groups around the country. However, the Tea Party is still the most important political factor in America today, and it shall remain that way.
Well, you know, I think part of that might be that the Tea Party has kind of reached a point where they feel like, you know, hey, meeting and waving signs that say taxed enough already was great. It certainly put us on the map. And now I see them doing things like, you know, last night my local Tea Party was meeting with a member of the city council in order to further the implementation of more spending cuts at the local level. So I think the Tea Party is definitely still there, still doing its job, but perhaps not as visible. I think you nailed it on the head when you said perhaps not as visible. But talk to me about what you see the Tea Party's role being as we head into the 2012 election. Do we need to have another march on Washington? Do we need to have a lot of rallies? Or are there other things that the Tea Party should be doing?
I think it's in the category of other things. The march on Washington, of course, the two that we had in 2009 and 2010 were very successful. However, we did realize that politics is local. And as you just mentioned, when we as Tea Partiers march into school board meetings or city council meetings and make ourselves known and visible in our local level and take control of those local precincts, many people don't realize that in order to become a precinct captain, the only thing you basically have to do is show up at the at those meetings. And usually there's just a few good old boys there, and many times if you go down there in numbers, you actually take over your precinct. So I believe that the Tea Party involvement and the Tea Party activity has to become exactly what we say it is, a grassroots effort, and that starts at home. And so that's how I see our strength remaining very viable into the future, is making sure that we are active in local politics.
I am always amazed when I hear a progressive, and it's always a white progressive, accuse the Tea Party of being racist. Now, you've been to a lot of Tea Parties. You've spoken at Tea Parties, including some very big ones. What's your take on the racism charge?
The racism charge is a very convenient one, and we do see this president and his minions, his administration, continuing to use this as some type of leverage. However, it has been one that has failed because it has not slowed the progress, the steamroller, the locomotive that is the Tea Party. I just left Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 3 weeks ago, and I spoke to a group of quote-unquote black conservatives up there. What you will see, especially in this 2010 election, and it's to our advantage, you'll see a lot of black conservatives and many others who have been hiding in the closet, who are fed up with what's been presented as a group of people who are rabid racist, biased, you know, bigots, what have you, come out of those closets and sweep this administration out of office. And I do believe we will reclaim the Senate. I left FreedomWorks in Washington, where I'm a fellow, a couple of weeks ago. In fact, I was there last week on Monday, and I was able to meet with some people, Rand Paul, Mike Lee, and I even walked over and had a sit-down with Senator Jim DeMint. And it will be a monumental what we're going to do in this 2012 election. So I encourage all of our folks to not lose heart. They have called us all types of names, Mark. We've survived it. We have not gone away. They have assassinated our character in just about every way they possibly could. We've survived it. We have not gone away. And we send this message that we will not go away.
I think one of the things that upsets me the most, CL, is that when you talk about we've endured all these charges, all these attacks, it would seem to me that the African-American conservatives who are in the Tea Party movement are receiving the majority of those attacks. And one of the things that I am personally fed up with is any African-American conservative in the movement being called all the typical names, House Negro,
Uncle Tom's,
all that.
I
was going to say, it's occurred to me that when you analyze the situation, you have one group of people who are saying, we're Americans, okay?
Right.
And then you've got another group that essentially is being controlled no longer through actual physical chains, but through the chains of dependency on welfare in many cases, who are saying, we'll trade our vote for a welfare check. And there are white people and Hispanics and Asians in this category too. But I find it ironic that they consider the African-American conservatives, who essentially are independently thinking and, you know, essentially saying, forget what the herd is doing. We're going to do what we want to do. We're going to follow our instincts, and that is to take advantage of the fruits of our labor and the things that capitalism have to offer. To label the – I'm sorry, you can tell I'm getting mad while I say this. To label the African-American conservative the Uncle Tom or the House Negro, and I don't like labeling anybody with that, but it's just ridiculous.
Absolutely. When you consider the fact that no one on the left stood up and said anything about the caricature of Condoleezza Rice being Aunt Jemima, that's the hypocrisy of it. I'll give you another example of that. Now, here you and I are two Americans, one who happens to have more melanin in his skin than the other. But we're both Americans. Our parents, whatever prices they paid for us to get to this conversation today, those prices were paid. But this conversation can only happen in America between two people who perhaps have such diverse backgrounds as you and I. This is the country where that happens. However, when you look at the relationship that a Al Sharpton has with, let's say, a Rachel Maddow, and then we look at the relationship that I have with you as far and other conservative hosts across the country and in Canada, even London, who are Caucasian, who are white. They're conservative. I'm conservative. Sharpton's liberal. Maddow's liberal. Now, what makes that relationship different than our relationship? Well, how come he's not an Uncle Tom for associating with the progressive Caucasian left, but I'm an Uncle Tom for associating with the conservative right? You see that there's a certain hypocrisy. If you're going to play the race card,
right,
you have to play the race card both ways, as far as that's concerned. Or otherwise, it's hypocrisy. What has happened is that a black man who is conservative in this country simply is devoid or should be devoid of an opinion. If he's going to be that way, Mark, he had better be doggone quiet about it, you see. Whereas an Al Sharpton can vilify you, He can vilify me because of his leftist opinion, because of his progressive opinion. He has a bully pulpit, but I very well better keep my mouth shut and stay on the porch. If I am with Mark Geller. You see, that's the hypocrisy in it, and that's what this movie, we finished the movie, Runaway Slave is all about. That's what the book is about, and that's what my mission is about in this country, is to expose that hypocrisy from the white and black liberal progressives on that side of the aisle.
It is crazy, and I tell you what, like I said, it's hard for me to talk about it without getting a little rabid, you know. But let's talk about the movie Runaway Slave. Now you were still piecing it together, still working on it, probably still shooting some of it the last time you were here. So it's in the can and it's ready to be released.
Yes, sir. It's in the can. They're editing even as we speak. We had about 100 hours of footage, and we're only needing a 90-minute movie, and we hopefully have come to a theater near you. We finished up in Los Angeles with Andrew Breitbart and Reverend Jesse Lee Peterson in this film. We have everyone from all slants, everybody from Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, to Van Jones in this film. We have interviews with various political figures like Senator Bitter, you know, and people like Bachman and folks like that, Herman Cain, in this film. It is a film, I believe, that will launch an honest discussion about race. We'll talk about some of the things that are uncomfortable to talk about, things that perhaps Caucasians talk about around their tables honestly with each other, and blacks talk about around their tables honestly with each other. We're able to share these conversations and then ask these questions in together as we view it together. We're hopefully that we can work out the deal with Regal Theaters to partially premiere it across the country. And then, of course, it'll be available on DVD for everyone. But, Mark, I really believe that the Lord has blessed us with a great idea. And I've kicked off a new film project as well. I just left Las Vegas and Los Angeles this past week talking with some people there who are helping me develop it. It's called Red, White, and Black, and one that I think you'll be very interested in. We'll have high-profile entities in this film, from sports figures to movie figures, rap figures, both conservative and liberals, who will be a part of this particular film, because it is they who make enormous amounts of money, who support this Obama administration that will be hit so hard if, in fact, the type of taxation goes forth. And we want to see, how do they justify that particular support of a progressive program when they make so much money and are part of that 1%?
That's a really good question. I know I've been in some form of sales or another for a large part of my life, and I can tell you that one of the things I've been taught since I studied sales in college is you got to give people the whiffum, the what's in it for me. And I think oftentimes with the Obama administration, a lot of these high-profile progressives haven't really thought about the whiffum very much. And maybe getting them to do that would be a great idea. That sounds like an exciting project, and we're definitely going to want to have you back for that. Now, is it too early for people to pre-order the film?
Probably you would pre-order around August.
Okay.
You can start pre-ordering around August. And you go to runawayslavemovie.com. You can tweet us or email us there, or to onenationbacktogod.com and email us there, and we can tell you the exact dates. But I do know that they are putting a lot of stuff on the cutting room floor right now, on the editing room floor right now, and we're just about to have the finished product in hand.
That's fantastic. I'm glad. The last time you were here, I know that, you know, again, it was still being shot and there was a lot of work left to be done. And I know you've put your heart and soul into this, Reverend Bryant, and I just want to congratulate you on bringing this project to fruition. That's wonderful.
Thank you so much for the support that all of you, like people like yourself, have given us, Mark. Even though it does seem like it was a long time, we were just 1 year in production, 1 year from just about start to finish. Most documentaries take 2-3 years, but the Lord bless us with a lot of favor and a lot of people of importance who cross our path.
I want to run something by you, and this ties into our subject somewhat. One of the things that's happened recently is we've had a number of high-profile experts come forward and say that the birth certificate that Barack Obama released has numerous computer anomalies in it, and in all likelihood is a fraud. And when I say experts, I'm talking about one woman who's written 12 books, another guy who's probably written 50 books. Both of them have been sought after national Adobe software experts. Retired Major General Paul Vallehi has said that there are three ex-CIA agents who are saying that the document is fraudulent. And one of the things we're hearing is that as people talk to members of Congress behind the scenes, they're saying, well, you know, we do believe that this document that was released is fraudulent. However, if we were to investigate that, the African-American community would probably riot from coast to coast, and we would have major civil unrest. So Congress really isn't going to take this up and address it. And I thought, what a racist comment. I mean, the idea that if Barack Obama had done something wrong and he were investigated for it, that the African-American community would just automatically riot. What's your take upon hearing this?
That is definitely bull hockey, as we say down this way sometimes, because if he had, and I do believe that there is definitely something there. I'm getting reports, as I'm looking at my screen now, that his mother's Social Security card is fraudulent. Mm. And so if that's the case, then this is a prefab president. Of course, to beat the Clinton machine, you had to be prefab anyway. those former CIA agents, I happen to have met one of them. And of course, because they are one of these types, you don't know me types,
right.
You can't mention their names or anything. But these are people who have worked with documents all around the world. This individual was one that worked with documents all around the world. And he said that the way that they're trained to spot a phony document is basically the same way a bank teller is trained to spot a fraudulent or a phony bill, is that you're exposed to real ones over and over. Not though you're not exposed to phonies, you're exposed to real documents.
Mm-hmm.
Over and over and over again, so that when one comes through that is not right in texture, in look, in outlay, you're able to question, what's this? And that's what they did with his birth certificate, even the sequential, the numeration of it.
Right.
And I'm telling you, Mark, that even though I would hate to think, that, and I hate to think, that we have inaugurated a fraud, because it makes us sort of look a little small among the eyes of those who think we should know better. I'm talking about around the world. And it means that we have inaugurated to the highest office in our land, most powerful office in the nation, someone who is not real. And I would hope to God that this is something, a figment of our imagination. But, Mark, the more we dig into it, the more we see that it's not. Now, African Americans, if in fact they have been played the fool, because even though it was not their vote that elected him, It was progressive votes, Caucasian white progressive votes, really, that combined with theirs and the Jewish vote and the women who elected him to office. It would make us all look like fools. But I have a feeling, and I know that we'd want to know this. And if Congress is saying the reason they're not investigating this is because it would create riots across the country, that's nuts. That is the silliest excuse for not following or looking at the rule of law that I possibly can imagine. And if, in fact, there is some truth to that, then, Mark, that gives me more fuel for my fire to turn on people like the so-called community leaders out there who are leading these people to a temptation and evil that their minds are so controlled by the left that they would actually turn on the truth.
I cannot believe for one moment that that would be the case. And I think that if Congress is telling, and retired Major General Paul Vallehi is one of the is the person who's actually spoken to several members of Congress and gotten that same response from all of them, if that's really their reason, that is one of the most racist things I have ever heard in my life, that African Americans would not be content to allow the judicial process, well, actually at first the impeachment process in the House and then the Senate, and then possibly any subsequent criminal investigation thereafter. The idea that they would not be content to allow the system to work, but would immediately begin rioting, is just one of the most insulting things I have ever heard. And I think it's amazing to me how often, what we hear oftentimes from the other side is so racist. And I don't even think white progressives know that they're racist, but they are, because they've made up their mind that somehow the African-American community, needs a bunch of white interlopers to step in the middle of things and help these people because they cannot help themselves. I mean, I get sick of it. I really do.
I have said this on many occasions, Mark, and still my speaking engagements are numerous. And I use this example a lot. Now, Geller, what is the origin of your name, your last name?
It's actually Galar, and it's a little strange because my family comes from Czechoslovakia, but they come there by way of France. Galar is originally a French name. My family, for better or for worse, was run out of France at the time of the French Revolution.
Okay, let's use this for an example then. There are many French Americans of French ancestry in this country. Where are their identifiable leaders? Where are their leaders? There are tons of Irish here. I know Ted Kennedy thought he was the Irish leader, but there were many Irish who were Republicans and so forth. Where are their leaders? The point I'm getting at is this, Mark. Well, how come black folks always have to have some kind of the black leader? Why do they have to be led around? Nobody leads me anywhere. I make decisions based on the way my father made decisions, his pocketbook. However it sat in his pocketbook, and whoever was going to be the person who put the money back in his pocketbook and create the opportunity for him to make more money to put in that pocketbook, that's who my father voted for. It didn't matter whether he was a Democrat, Republican, although down in these neck of the woods, you probably couldn't vote back in my father's day if you were a Republican, because it's Democrat control, it was Democrat politics back then, but the Democrat Party was totally different at that point in time. However, okay, are you there, Mark?
I am.
Okay. What I see here happening is that you have so many folks looking toward, quote-unquote, black leaders. We're not stupid. We don't need anybody to lead us anywhere. Other people just don't have that type of thing. There may have been a time in this country when we were trying to find our way after slavery and then through the turmoil of the 60s that we needed somebody to show us where, the dipping holes and the fishing holes were. But in 2010, no. In fact, if one thing Barack Obama does prove, he does prove that America is the greatest success story the world has ever known.
I think you're absolutely right about that, and I don't think there's a need for African-American leaders like Al Sharpton, especially like
right.
Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson.
Right.
And one of the things that's occurred to me is the African parts of the African-American community think that the white progressives care so much is that if you go back and you look into their ideology and their beliefs and who some of their leaders were, people like Frances Fox Pivens and, you know, her now late husband Cloward, they actually talked about bringing this country down to its knees by overloading the welfare system. Now, what that implies to me is that once they get people on that system, they don't want to get them off.
That's right, Mark. And I'm going to tell you something. If we're not careful, that system will be expanded, not just for poor whites, blacks, and Latinos. It will be expanded, and we're beginning to see it affect what once was the middle class. Here in Louisiana, our life's blood is oil and gasoline. Once out in the Gulf of Mexico, there were many oil rigs doing 24/7, I mean, for 20 years, 30 years, pumping in and out without a spill. One spill comes about, and really we're not seeing any of the effects of it now. I just left Gulf Fort Mississippi a couple of weeks ago, about a month ago, 2 months ago. And one spill, and the environmentalists lose their minds and create this hysteria that we have to take the rigs out of the Gulf, and the president creates a moratorium there. What does that do? It creates panic. It creates hardship here in the state of Louisiana, and it also drives the price of oil up and makes us more dependent on foreign entities when we have plenty of oil in the Gulf of Mexico, off the coast of Louisiana, Texas, North Dakota, and in Alaska. We have the keys to solving our problems, but yet, because there is a design, and remember, Mark, I was once president of the NAACP in Garland, Texas.
That's right, yeah.
Years ago. I know what the agenda is. I've seen both sides of this coin. And believe me, there is a progressive agenda, not only to enslave the poor, but to eliminate, and I use that word very, very forcefully now, eliminate the middle class so that you have elite and you have poor.
One of the things that I want to do, because we've only got about a minute and a half left, is ask you exactly how people can get a hold of not only the film Runaway Slave in late August, but also the book Lead Us to Temptation, Deliver Us to Evil, because I don't want to let you off the air without having you tell us a little bit about that and where people can get it.
By all means, go to Amazon.com, and you can definitely get the book there. But if you want to order the book, you can call, or you can go to OneNationBackToGod.com, OneNationBackToGod.com, all one word. And, of course, we look forward to hearing from you. Call my personal assistant. I give this number to you, 318-221-0777, 318-221-0777. That will be Mindy, who will answer in my office, the One Nation Back to God office. And, Mark, I do want to thank you so much for having me on today, and I certainly hope that our relationship will extend on into the future.
It absolutely will. Thank you for being here.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillar, a production of the Conservative Broadcasting Network.